Hello, Mad Bombers, and, you know, for kids and all the ships at sea, and welcome to A Very Good Year, the movie podcast where we invite a guest to pick their favorite year of movies and talk to us about that year. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today is a tremendously talented independent filmmaker whose credits include RSO Registered Sex Offender, Harmony and Me, Somebody Up There Likes Me, Seven Chinese Brothers, Infinity Baby, and Francis Ferguson. His new film is called Lousy Carter, and it stars David Krumholtz. This is the one, the only Bob Byington. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do this and come on the show. I've been a fan of your work for a really long time, and it's a real pleasure to have you.
Excellent. Thank you. Do you guys say that, you know, for kids and at the intro for every show?
No, we change out the what's at the okay. very beginning for the films that we'll be all discussing right. on that show. So that's
that might be a thing. All right.
Yeah. It would be wild if that was something we said every show and we finally had an excuse to talk about where it comes from. So first of all, Lousy Carter is really terrific. We both really enjoyed it. One of the things that I really love about your films is that you frequently cast actors as your leads who are more frequently seen in supporting roles. And Krumholtz, you know, certainly falls into that category. What made you want to work with him? And was this script written with him in mind?
Yeah, that's a good question. David, I'd worked with him on Francis Ferguson. And he's a very talented actor. And, A lot of the reviews we got for Francis Ferguson were like, yeah, the movie's okay. Krumholtz scenes are amazing. Like we kind of kept hearing that. And some reviews were like, movie's terrible. Krumholtz is great. So you know, we're getting a lot of feedback about Krumholtz. And when you're on set with him and he's kind of doing his like pinball wizard thing, he's quite something. And yeah. I knew that I wanted to try to like, he was originally going to play the supporting role in this, and then one thing led to another, and he jumped to the lead role, and we're really happy about that.
Yeah, he's fantastic. You know, and your entire cast really is full of terrific character actors who, you know, are always so good. Krumholtz, Martin Starr, Macon Blair, Stephen Root, Olivia Thirlby. But the discovery here is a new actor named Luxie Banner, who is just phenomenal. Where did you find her?
Well, she came in to be one of the classroom participants in a sort of more general role. Mm-hmm. We had an idea for who was going to play her part when we were setting up the movie. Luxie ended up helping us audition some of the other actors that we were hiring for, you know, to come in and day play. And she made an immediate impression on me. She was like you say, she's great in the movie, but she was also great, you know, when we're just auditioning these other actors. And kind of with David moving from supporting to lead, one thing led to another with Luxie, and she ended up in the pole position. And it just worked out.
Yeah. Well, she is phenomenal. One of the other things I really dig about it is that there are a lot of really great kind of self-referential touches throughout, moments that remind us that, you know, that this is a film by a filmmaker who with some experience. And the line that especially jumped out at me was, if the movie makes money, which it won't, you'll make more, which seems like a line that you have maybe said or at least thought more than once in your career.
Definitely.
To that end, you know, you work in a very specific style. You have a really distinctive voice. Is it difficult to preserve that voice and to maintain it in what has, over the past few years especially, become an extremely commercialized independent film landscape?
That's a good question. I think when we try to push the budgets bigger and we try to play in the world of agents and, you know, do the sort of things that the things might be moving toward, it doesn't really work out for me. And I end up sort of like retreating back to the, you know, we experimented with this budget and this cast being bigger when we were planning it. It was going to get shot in LA. We're going to have a big TV actor play Lousy Carter. And it just didn't go. It fell apart. And, so I, you know, we're planning another movie, and it's almost like rather than making those mistakes of trying to make it bigger now, it's almost like I'm working with Jay Duplass, and I think we both want to try to make it as small as possible.
Yeah.
And one nice thing about Jay is he makes big movies. He's involved with big movies, but he also like really likes the idea of a small intimate movie. And so I'm hoping that, you know, that we don't go down the road of pie in the sky type thinking and we just like make it small.
Well, you know, best of luck with it, 'cause it's a terrific picture. And I hope, honestly, number one, I hope, you know, it leads to keeps you working. But number two, I hope we get to see Crummy in more leading roles, because he really does carry the picture with ease.
I think he's between Oppenheimer and some of the other stuff he's been doing. I think he's, you know, you're going to be seeing him in some things.
All right. Well, what year did you pick to discuss with us today and why?
1994. I'd originally stabbed 1977. But then realized that the movies that I wanted to talk about from that year were movies you'd already talked about last year, I guess, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I picked five out of 5-star movies. So, I mean, I'm excited to talk about these movies, although it's going to be embarrassing because you guys are going to know more about these movies than I do. And I'm supposed to be the ringer, but I truly love every movie I selected, so...
Well, great. Well, and sort of to contextualize this for us, you know, biographically, where were you as a filmmaker and as a film goer in 1994?
Well, very young person, very idealistic, and actually saw two of these movies at the Telluride Film Festival.
Oh, wow.
And saw the North American premiere of Naked and Red. And Naked, they actually showed to the staff, and we didn't know anything about the movie. They would show the staff this movie. They're like, "Hey, we're going to show this movie at the festival. What do you guys think?" So they would show these movies to us without us knowing anything. So imagine like Naked coming on and not knowing anything about the movie at all, and it would blow you away, and it blew me away.
Yeah. Yeah. So you were doing the thing where like your staff there, you're volunteering so that you can go to the festival and see movies and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then, and had you started making films yet? I know you hadn't made a feature yet by then.
No, I hadn't made anything. And, the work that I did in the '90s is work that I, you know, try to pretend doesn't exist. And
it's really as, not that as hard. We all do. Yeah.
Yeah. And everyone else is complicit in sort of like ignoring all of it. And so, I like to think it sort of sprang fully formed at 2007 as making RSO. But yeah, there's some 90s skeletons in my closet. Yes.
Gotcha. Gotcha. All right. Well, I'm really anxious to get into this top five, which is fantastic. Before we do, we're going to find out what was going on in the world outside of Telluride in 94. Here is Mike with headlines.
1994 was all about America winning the Cold War in the most obnoxious way possible. Mm-hmm. We were killing it on the world stage. Mm-hmm. January 10, Ukraine agrees to give up over 1,800 nuclear warheads and 175 long-range missiles. They agreed to give back the stockpile to Russia in trade for guarantees of their sovereignty.
Oh, okay.
I know, and we do a lot of work on Ukraine and black diplomats, and there's all these people that are like, maybe we shouldn't have given the nukes back. And I'm not so sure. Anyway, it's a very complicated conversation that obviously is ongoing. In February, Byron De La Beckwith was sentenced to life in prison for the murder of Medgar Evers 30 years before.
Bye.
Miserable prick. Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy, right?
Good riddance.
Also in February, Howard Stern talked a guy out of jumping off the George Washington Bridge. And however you might or might not feel about Howard Stern, I feel like that's an that's a good thing, no matter what, right?
Unalloyed good when you talk a guy off of the bridge. Yes. Yes, I'll give him that.
Yeah, right? In April, Richard Nixon died.
Bye.
In May, Nelson Mandela was officially sworn in as president of South Africa. And that's the one reason to be glad Byron De La Beckwith was still alive.
Yes, correct.
Right? That's yes. good.
Yeah.
In June was the day, June 17, 1994. And I'm not going to tell you what happened about it because there's a whole documentary by that name and it's fantastic and you should watch it.
Yes.
One of my favorites of all time.
Shout out.
June 17, 1994. It's very easy to remember. Also in June, Aerosmith became the first band to allow their fans to download an entire new song from the internet. You know, none of them knew what the fuck that meant.
Correct.
They had a marketing guy. They were like, whatever you think, Steve.
Yeah.
In August, 25-year-old singer R. Kelly married 15-year-old Aaliyah, and there has been no excuse to say anything nice about that guy ever since.
Amen.
The TV sitcom Friends debuted in September, and it is just as awful now as it was then. Just the blandest excuse for culture since the opening of the Lawrence Welk show.
All right. This is a deliberate attempt by you to bait me for my affection.
And it's been working for 30 years.
For this middle brow show. I'm not going to rise to the bait, Mike. Carry on. What else happened in 1994? What else? What else you got?
In November, Jeffrey Dahmer was beaten to death at age 34 by fellow inmate Christopher Scarver. And you know what?
Yeah.
I'm not for the death penalty, but I'm not making posters for that fucking guy.
But
finally, in December, was the release of both the Sony PlayStation and Netscape Navigator, and that ate up an incredible amount of the next 6 years.
Yes.
Oh, the 90s.
Yeah.
Remember pre-9/11? That shit was amazing. That's headlines.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Bob Byington, you ready to do a top five?
Yes.
All right, so I'm just going to, we're going to go in a random order that even I don't know. I'm just going to throw each one to Bob, and he's going to give us one of his picks. So, Bob, what is the first movie on your top five for 1994?
Let's go with Hudsucker Proxy.
From the award-winning creators of Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, and Joel Silver, who brought you Lethal Weapon and Die Hard, comes a comedy that's sure to take your breath away.
It could work.
It should work.
It would work.
It's working already.
The Hudsucker Proxy.
What the hell is it?
The Coen brothers' notorious flop. The movie that almost ended their careers. Do you have any particular memories of when you first saw Hudsucker?
No.
That's fair. What do you love about the Hudsucker Proxy?
Well, I was a big Coen Brothers guy, and you know, I'd seen Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink.
Yep.
I knew these movies inside and out, and I also sort of knew that they were gonna. There was this, you know, script in a drawer kind of movie that they'd had in the 80s that they couldn't get made, and they'd gotten into bed with Joel Silver. I knew all these things, and I knew that they felt like they needed quote unquote real money to make the movie. You know, they'd had no money for Blood Simple, some money for Raising Arizona, a little bit more for Miller's Crossing, decent budget for Barton Fink. I mean, they had like indie budgets, and they wanted like a blockbuster budget, or, you
yes.
know, an early 90s independent blockbuster budget. I heard $35 to $40 million.
Yeah.
And I was excited to see it. It was definitely like felt like a departure from the movies that they'd made already. So I was probably like a lot of people, like, eh, it's okay, you know. And mm-hmm. then when, you know, saw it later, like a lot of us revisited it, where we're like, oh my God, this thing's amazing.
Yes. Yeah. It you understand why they needed that much money. When you look at it, because it's a gorgeously made movie, it's, you know, it's a period piece. The production design is impeccable. The cinematography is gorgeous. It's got big stars in it. Paul Newman is in a Coen Brothers movie. But it's also very much a Coen Brothers movie. It's very much that, you know, their idiosyncratic style almost to the nth degree. There's no way that movie was going to make back that kind of money. What is it in particular about their style that you enjoy so much?
Their intelligence. You can feel their intelligence in every movie they make. They make really good decisions. And there was a minute where I was like, let's let the Coen brothers make all the movies. You know, no one else should get to make a movie except them.
Sure.
And someone had just mentioned that Roger Deakins shot the movie. And again, there's that kind of like intelligence that's going into the every single decision. I feel the same way when I'm watching a David Fincher movie. I can feel the intelligence at work. And I really respond to that. Yes, as a filmmaker, you're like constantly trying to learn, and they're not really emulatable, but you know, I feel like I've learned things from them. And it's nice to have that feeling while you're watching something.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. The Jennifer Jason Leigh performance in this is somewhat divisive, I guess. I don't know. I think it's a genius performance. And also one that I saw, I think, before I saw His Girl Friday and a lot of the sort of clear influences on it. What do you think of the work she's doing in this?
Well, I love it. But again, I was probably confused by it when I first saw the movie. I mean, I think you got to come back to it.
Yes.
And trust her. And she had gotten a tribute in Telluride, I remember. I don't know if when she got a tribute in Telluride, but that was a big deal because it was like really early in her career, they gave her a tribute. And they were like saying like, this woman is, you know, she can act. And showing movies like Miami Blues that, you know, didn't get the attention for her that you might think it would, and kind of has stood the test of time for her. And then, you know, of course, Jennifer Jason Leigh has done all this phenomenal work lately. And so she's definitely that performance, and she's stood the test of time. She hasn't caved, and she's doing great work.
I revisited this one. I hadn't seen it probably in I don't know, a decade or so. I was really struck by the audacity of the ending of this, by the way that they are willing to sort of bend the rules of movies, the rules of storytelling, the rules of time in order to sort of to go to a place that you don't expect it to go. In a weird way, I feel like that feels sort of similar to what you do in a lot of your films. Is this, you know, on a storytelling level, would you consider this film to be an influence?
No, no. I mean, they're in a completely different league. I'm playing double A ball. They're in the main, and so no. But I was thinking about No Country for Old Men, and you know that movie, just slightly for a second. Although Roger Deakin that also that movie ends with the character talking about two dreams he had. And if I were teaching a film class, you know, on day one, I'd be like, don't end your movie with a character talking about two dreams he had, you know? And yet they're so good at their jobs that it completely works. And you probably get emotional just thinking about how effective it is. And, but yeah, there's just like, it's just such a Hudsucker, such a fun movie. And they're so committed to the storytelling that the ending, you know, it works.
It does. It truly does. All right. Bob Byington, then what is the second movie on your top five for 94?
Let's go with Speed.
Let's do.
Pop quiz, hot shot.
There's a bomb on a bus. If it drops below 50, it blows up. What do you do?
The game began with the ultimate test.
Where's Jeff?
Where do you think?
Now.
Stay under, get off.
Get off.
Much better.
He's the only solution.
Pop quiz. You have a hair trigger aimed at your head. What do you do?
Keanu Reeves.
What do you do?
Speed.
This one I actually got to revisit in the theater like 3 weeks ago.
Wow.
Because Alamo Drafthouse is doing, you know, a 94 series right now where they just ran a lot of, frankly, a lot of movies we're going to talk about today. I hadn't seen it in a theater since opening weekend. And Jesus Christ, man, it still plays. I would imagine that, you know, someone who is really familiar with your work might be surprised to see a big, loud action blockbuster like this on a 94 top five. What do you love about this movie?
Well, I kind of remember seeing it, and I'd never really seen a movie like Speed before. And I think a lot of people had that feeling when we saw it. It's like, yes, there had been sort of big, quote unquote, dumb movies that, you know, were action oriented. But how did it play for you? Was it playing?
Gangbusters. Absolutely, yeah. Played like gangbusters. I mean, DeBont did not have an illustrious career, I would say, as a, you know, he made a few good pictures and then several that weren't, but it's put together just like a Swiss watch, you know, and first of all, in a lot of ways, it's like, it's almost three movies in one. Like we all think about, you know, the bus and the title, but that's really only about the middle hour of the movie. It's got this whole other great setup sequence and with the hostages in the elevator, and then this incredible, you know, subway chase towards the end. And I think it's that it packs so much in, that it's so sort of fast paced and breathtaking and relentless, that still as an audience member, you really get caught up in the damn thing.
And you've got Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock, you know, they're going to be big movie stars, and they're kind of like coming into it in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And something about that, you know, a movie star earning their stripes. That's, you know, she was pretty unknown.
Yes, she was. That was the other thing that really struck me, having not seen it in a good long while, was, I mean, it's a movie star performance from someone who's not a movie star yet. And even, you know, in reaction shots and cutaways, just when she's looking at Keanu Reeves, you can't stop looking at her. She's so engaged and charismatic and interesting, and you're pulling for the two of them, even though it's this sort of, you know, check a box potentially romance, but they're so very, very good together that you really get invested in that. How about Dennis Hopper in this? How do you feel about him? Love him.
And I think there was something really like fun for me that he was doing a role like this, you know, just because he was like an art guy. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic, of course.
Yeah. It's still plays so well, and I think it's probably the one that has held up best of the, you know, the Die Hard on a blank movies. You know, all of these sort of, you know, it's Die Hard on a bus, and we had Die Hard on ships, and Die Hard on planes, and Die Hard on trains, even.
What's the difference between Die Hard and Speed? You know, like, is Die Hard making more of an effort to not be ridiculous, or is Speed like telling you, like, hey, we're going to give you this kind of ridiculous premise up front for the movie, and we don't care? Like, what that's what I want to know. What's going on?
I think that's a pretty accurate assessment. Yeah, that, like, you know, that. I mean, Die Hard was important when it happened, because it was sort of it felt like an attempt to ground the action movie in a kind of reality, coming out of the sort of Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Rambo era, where you had Bruce Willis, who looked a little more like a regular guy and who could, you know, bleed and get hurt, and there's all that stuff with his feet and all of that. Whereas, you know, this doesn't really have those dimensions. It's very much strap in for a ride. I feel like that's sort of the way it establishes itself from the beginning, and you kind of go with that. Not that the relationships and the characters aren't of interest in it in one way or another.
Well, the thing had been sort of established, like you said, right? Die Hard on a whatever, right? It had been mm-hmm. established. So the challenge at that point is not sort of revealing, you know, what's interesting about the story. The challenge is like how we do it.
Right.
You know, it's like everybody's had a cheeseburger, but I'm about to give you the best goddamn cheeseburger you've ever had in your life.
Yeah.
Did you see this one in theaters originally when it first came out?
Oh, yeah. Everyone did.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a huge movie that summer. Yeah, it was a huge movie that summer. Yeah. I remember going into the summer, it's like 20th Century Fox's two big movies for that summer were Speed and True Lies. And the word that had gotten out ahead of time was that Speed was testing better than True Lies, which had a much bigger budget and much higher expectations. And obviously, if you watch them both now, Speed is also the one that has aged quite considerably better, I think.
Hmm.
All right, Bob, what then is the third movie on your top five for 94?
Why don't we go with Chungking Express?
On the streets of Hong Kong, a mysterious woman, a young cop, and an innocent dreamer are about to meet where mystery and romance collide. Miramax and Quentin Tarantino's Rolling Thunder Pictures present Chungking Express.
Wong Kar-wai. When did you first see this one?
I think, you know, that Tarantino did that VHS thing with it.
Yes.
And I was a guy who saw it, I think probably mid late 90s.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, when did that VHS release? Do you know?
It was fairly, I mean, that was its initial US home video release. Yeah, it was through the Rolling Thunder Pictures label. I still remember that VHS box so clearly from my video store days with his mug on the corner down there. And then he did the intro at the beginning to explain to you, the Tarantino devotee, why this movie was great and why you should like it and why he liked it. And he did a few of those, which were frankly all we're seeing. What do you like so much about this particular film?
Well, my asterisk on this movie is a similar asterisk to a lot of people where we don't really like the first part that much. And it's the and I've talked to a lot of people who feel the same way. It's the second story that's kind of the tour de force. And you're welcome to defend the first part of the movie and I'll listen. But there were a couple things. Like, first of all, Wong Kar-wai is obviously an important filmmaker. I could say a couple things about that. There's something about his, the way he thinks about making a movie that's so, there's an immediacy to it.
Yeah.
That is so important to him, or that's second nature to him. And, you know, when you're making a movie, that immediacy is constantly under attack. You're constantly getting influenced by and you're constantly like receiving data that's reducing that immediacy.
Yeah.
And part of your job is to try to, like, you know, cut that back as much as you can. So that was a big thing for me. And I watched that movie a lot more, you know, later in life, more like in the 2000s, fives and tens kind of thing. And the big thing for me is the music, probably. And I think a lot of people would say the same thing. Like, I'd never seen a movie that used music the way he does. And I think it's proof that he's a genius, that he did what he did with that song.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd really like to know what the story of that song was. And I really wanted to try to make a movie. I made a movie called Harmony and Me and originally just wanted to use an Elton John song that would just play through the whole movie. And
right,
that was kind of the original idea for that movie. And that dream died because Elton John's songs cost,
fortune.
Yeah, five times what we spent on the whole movie. So,
Jesus.
Yeah. But anyway, again, you guys probably, Michael, you probably know more about this movie than I do. So,
I mean, when we did our 94 show last season, at the end, we each pick our, you know, recommend a movie from 94. And this was Mike's recommendation for 94. This is a favorite film of his.
It's just, I mean, it's one of the first sort of, and I had to have seen it in that same. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the box cover, but I mean, that was when it came here.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't sort of seeing the Chinese language versions or whatever. Right. It's just so atmospheric. Like you mentioned the music and, you know, I mean, I can definitely see what you're saying about the different parts and sort of how it gets more starts happening as it goes. But for me, like, it just sort of feels like, I don't know, man, like rain and dark blue lights. And it just sort of is the feel of the whole thing that is the thing that has really like stayed with me now. You know, I mean, I know the story, but when I think about the movie, it's almost, you know, it's just sort of images and music. But yeah, and it maintains that. And I think that it's one of those things that it's, you know, that was what was interesting about their movies when we first started seeing them, was that it was obvious that they had seen a lot of American movies, but they weren't necessarily making movies for an American audience.
Right.
And that change of voice was just really refreshing.
Yeah.
Interesting too, that he sort of brought it out in an era when a lot of people were trying to copy him. And it's such a different feel, you know, from anything that he was doing. And that was nice, too. That it sort of like actually made him feel more authentic in a way.
Who, Tarantino? Tarantino, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you sort of, if all he was recommending was John Woo movies, you're sort of like, well, obviously.
Sure.
You know, but it actually made him feel like more of a film, a genuine sort of cineast or whatever word you want to use.
Right.
That he was recommending these movies that were so different than his own work.
Definitely. Yeah. And I know this was, I mean, a lot of people's first Wong Kar Wai for that reason. Bob, I'm assuming it was yours as well.
Yeah.
Is it your favorite of his films, or is there another one that you like as much?
I looked at some of his other films. This is the favorite. A lot of people like the one that's on all the top 10 lists.
Oh, In the Mood for Love. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had seen that at LACMA, and that was a pretty extraordinary screening. And but there's something about Chungking Express that's, you know, going to stay number one for me.
I agree. I feel the same way. All right. So that brings us to the fourth film on your top five for 94. What's it going to be, Bob?
Naked, the Mike Leigh's Naked.
It was a sensation at the Cannes Film Festival, winning Best Actor and Best Director awards. At the Toronto Film Festival, it won the Critics' Prize. From acclaimed director Mike Leigh, the creator of High Hopes and Life is Sweet, Naked, a new film by Mike Leigh.
This is...
A Mike Leigh.
The Mike Leigh, yes. So take us back then to that very first screening that you mentioned, that Telluride screening, and knowing nothing about this. It certainly gets your attention from frame one. What were your impressions then, and sort of had you seen any Mike Leigh films before this one?
Yeah, I had seen High Hopes, which is a movie I really liked a lot. Naked is very different from High Hopes. But High Hopes had a big impact on me. Watching such a, you know, it's a low budget TV movie, I think. Or I mean, I could be wrong about High Hopes, but it was made on a low budget, and it's very dialogue. But you know, I'd certainly never seen anything like David Thewlis on a movie screen, you know, and to be caught off guard the way we all were at that screening. And to have him kind of like do what he does in that movie, it's impossible to quantify the effect that it had on me. Just dazzling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, at risk of opening a whole other can of worms, you know, this, the question of the unlikable protagonist is one that I know haunts a lot of filmmakers, especially when they're getting notes from people who don't know what they're talking about. You've certainly had your share of unlikable protagonists. So I would imagine that in that way in particular, this is a pretty formative picture for you.
Well, if you're going to have someone like, you know, Martin Sheen shooting people in the back, I mean, he better be charismatic, right? It's the same thing with Thewlis. I mean, Mike Leigh knows that this is a charismatic actor. And so he's, and this is a lesson I think I may have learned from him. It's like, yes, you can have people do things that are quote unquote unsympathetic and unlikable if you have, you know, talented performers.
Yeah. Yeah. We have heard a lot sort of over the years about the Leigh methodology, the way that he writes his scripts sort of in collaboration with actors, in improvisation, that sort of thing. I mean, obviously the results are incredible. That sounds also like a bit of a nightmare to do as a filmmaker. Like what is your sort of takeaway on that professionally as a way of working, as a way of writing a script?
Well, yeah, I'm familiar with that idea. And there was a, you know, certainly a world where you're like, oh, I'd really like to do that, you know, write the script, have rehearsal time with the actors, get the material the way you want it, write the script again, or, you know, write the script that you come up with through the rehearsal, and then have the actors learn that material and then film those scenes. Like that's a time consuming process, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because as I'm thinking, like, Naked isn't even my favorite Mike Lee movie. Topsy Turvy is my favorite Mike Lee movie.
Wow. Yeah.
This is like the Coen brothers, Mike Lee, like you feel the intelligence at work when he's making a movie, you know, and it's very attractive.
Right.
There's nothing in the movie that he hasn't really thought about and thought about a lot for, you know, for a long time. And then of course he gets, you know, all these deeply talented actors. So, you know, he's kind of, I don't know what he's doing right now, but the movies that he made were setting a bar for, you know, filmmaking. And it's very, it's a way to work that you don't run into too often.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and also, you know, as you're watching it, it's a long film. It's 2+ hours. And at the beginning, you know, there's a sense that this could be extremely monotonous. That if we're, you know, we're just sort of seeing this clearly, this person who's not going to change these specific kinds of encounters. But then the way that he manages to tell the story, not by sort of overt plot movement, but just by the combinations of characters that he puts together and what he has and the ways in which they react to each other, I think is pretty ingenious from a, you know, just from a structural script writing level. And then the way that everything sort of comes together at the end, which can feel formulaic when you say it like that, but it feels so, I don't know. I guess that's what's so striking about his work is that it feels so incredibly organic.
Yes.
Even though, yes, exactly. And again, all anchored on this incredible David Thewlis performance.
What I would say about like what turns me off, like when I'm watching a movie today is like, if you're watching a movie where you feel like the filmmakers have not thought about the lived in quality that you're talking about, the atmospherics, it drives me nuts. And you know, certainly 50, 60, 70% of the time you're getting films made where that no one has thought about that at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems to me slightly ridiculous not to think about it.
Yeah, no. And I can honestly, I can very much see that in your work. Like Lousy Carter very much feels like a movie that knows what it is to be on that campus, to be in those meetings, to be in those graduate seminars, to it's a film that understands the world that it dwells in a way that's kind of Mike Lee-ish in a way that hadn't occurred to me before.
Okay, good.
All right, so that brings us to the conclusion. What is the final film on the 94 top five?
I don't know what your preferred pronunciation is, but it's Krzysztof Kieślowski's Red.
A beautiful woman enters the world of a seductive stranger whose secret leads her into a mystery and whose past reveals her destiny. Critics across the nation are calling it one of the year's 10 best movies. Siskel and Ebert give it 2 thumbs up. The New York Post says Irene Jacob is enchanting. The New York Times calls her mysterious, seductive. And the Chicago Sun-Times says Red is a fascinating puzzle. Irene Jacob, Red.
My preferred pronunciation is when someone else says it, so thank you.
What about Mike?
I think you nailed it. I think Jason's right. I think it's an argument that we're not prepared to have as native English speakers.
Let's take the rest of our time discussing the pronunciation of Karasmaki. I wanted to put a Karasmaki film on the list, but Karasmaki is probably the biggest influence on me as a filmmaker. So he had sort of, I don't know when he made La Vida Boheme, but I don't think it was 94. Maybe it was. But anyway, Red.
Yeah.
I had seen Blue at Telluride and I loved Blue, and Juliette Binoche was there and Kieślowski was, I'm pretty sure they were both there. Juliette Binoche was basically the most beautiful woman in the world in the early 90s. And so she had a big impact on pretty much everyone at Telluride. And then I don't know if he'd made Red yet. They made, you know, he made Blue, White and Red in some type of succession, but
right.
And absurdly quickly. For the quality level, I remember seeing White between Blue and Red and not liking it, not understanding it really at all.
Okay.
And then Red, again, this was a Telluride film where Irene Jacob had come to Telluride and Kieślowski was there. And again, the glamour and these were very glamorous people. I know that Kieślowski is sort of the champion of the working class and had made the Decalogue, but he's very much like the quintessential European film director. And he was, you know, to pass away soon thereafter. Red is the movie that I revisited most recently of the five we've talked about. I couldn't believe how good it was. I sort of put it on thinking that I would kind of watch it maybe with one eye, and it ended up being like deeply engrossing and just phenomenal.
Yeah, I made the same mistake with it two nights ago, so I sympathize with that error. What is it about these films in particular that is so sort of ravishing, in your opinion?
Well, I will say about Red, I have the Decalogue scripts, and they have a preface from Stanley Kubrick, and he says the great thing about these guys is they know how to dramatize ideas. And the thing about Red is like it's dramatizing an idea, and it's like a very kind of like, you know, basically this retired judge is spying on his neighbors, right?
Right.
And you're thinking, well, like, oh, there's not really much at stake in this story, you know? Like, this is not, the stakes are higher probably in Speed than in Red, right?
Right.
There's something about the way Kieślowski works where you're just deeply invested in what's going on. And I don't know how he does it. I have no idea. And I don't know what the through line is for the five films. I mean, that's your guys' job, right? I mean, you guys have to like figure out what that is.
Yes. I first saw these movies in, I don't know, 98, and I'm still working on that. I'm still formulating that particular thesis. Did you go back to White? Do you still feel the same way? Do you still have the same reaction to that one?
I went back to it and liked it more. I probably didn't understand sexual jealousy when I saw it. And
sure.
When I saw it again, I sort of did. And
sure.
It's a movie about sexual jealousy.
Yeah.
And it's held up a little bit better. And that lead performance held up a little bit better. But when I saw it the first time, I had no understanding or idea of what was going on at all.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm glad it ended up working out for you. They're terrific movies, and he's a fantastic filmmaker. Gone too soon. Bob, thank you so much for that sublime top five. All great pictures. Now let's find out about the big doings of the entertainment business in the year 1994. Here is Mike with the Hollywood Minute.
Hollywood freaks on the Hollywood scene.
There were several pictures of note in the running for Oscars in 94, but the big showdown was between Forrest Gump and Pulp Fiction, which faced off in the Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor categories. Gump ran the table on all the head-to-heads. In fact, Fiction's only Oscar would come in the Best Original Screenplay category, one of the few where it wasn't competing against Robert Zemeckis' Boomer Nostalgia play. Gump would win a total of 6 Oscars that night.
Bob, where do you stand in the Gump v. Fiction wars?
I know when Gump came out, it was kind of a joke to people of my, you know, ilk.
Sure.
And that Pulp Fiction was kind of more of like exciting for us. I had a bootleg VHS of Pulp Fiction called Plump.
Nice.
And I think also that I saw Forrest Gump before I appreciated Robert Zemeckis the way I do now. And I think Gump would play better for me today. I don't know if I want to watch it, but I think it would play better for me today.
Fiction was, you know, a huge movie for a lot of independent filmmakers and film lovers in the 90s. I mean, what was your initial response to that one?
Well, not to bring Telluride up again, but I had seen Reservoir Dogs at Telluride, and it was a phenomenal screening. And so there was a real eagerness about Pulp Fiction coming out that, you know, that doesn't really happen as much anymore. You know,
right.
There are these auteurs where you're kind of waiting for the next movie. Like, I don't think that's happening much, but it definitely happened with Pulp Fiction.
Other Oscar winners that year included Jessica Lange, Best Actress for Blue Sky, Diane Wiest, Best Supporting Actress for Bullets Over Broadway, and Martin Landau, Best Supporting Actor for Ed Wood. I'm going to pronounce her name differently every time she comes up.
That's fine. I appreciate that. I appreciate it. Bob, I have found that filmmakers tend to have a real soft spot for the movie Ed Wood. How do you feel about that one?
Well, I had read that Soderbergh script, Edward Ford. Do you know about that script, that Lem
No. Dobbs? No, I don't.
Lem Dobbs has a unpublished or un... His Soderbergh's dream project is this this Edward Ford script that is very much in the world of Ed Wood.
Okay. So
I'd read that script and sort of wanted Ed Wood to be that. But Ed Wood is a movie I sort of keep wanting to revisit and didn't like it much when I saw it. I don't know why. I don't think I like Johnny Depp as much as people like Johnny Depp or liked Johnny Depp.
Yeah, I was going to say the past tense is definitely called for there.
But I was right. I was right about Johnny Depp. Okay.
You were. Congratulations, Bob.
I knew it 30 years ago.
Gump was also the second biggest box office hit of the year, behind only Disney's juggernaut, The Lion King. Other movies in the top 10 that year included True Lies, The Mask, The Flintstones, and Dumb and Dumber.
Bob, any favorites in there? Any pictures you enjoyed in that top 10?
There's some stuff in Dumb and Dumber that we all love. And I think I like Jeff Daniels in Dumb and Dumber more than Jim Carrey. But yeah, there's some stuff in there.
That'll work.
On April 14th, Turner Classic Movies began broadcasting.
Yay!
Let's get a round of applause for that.
Yay!
Give us movie nerds another reason to stay indoors. In October, shortly after winning his first Best Director Oscar, Steven Spielberg joined Jeffrey Katzenberg and David Geffen to found DreamWorks SKG. Wow. And in long-running franchise news, Pierce Brosnan was announced as the new Bond, and Vil Kalmer, my favorite Czechoslovakian actor, Vil Kalmer. And Val Kilmer was announced as the new Batman.
All right.
A few births of note in 1994, actresses Julia Garner, Saoirse Ronan, Dakota Fanning, Margaret Qualley, and Zoe Deutsch. And actor Kelvin Harrison Jr.
All right.
Fond farewells in 94 to actors Joseph Cotten, Claude Akins, Cesar Romero, Fernando Rey, George Peppard, Cameron Mitchell, Peter Cushing, Tom Yule, Woody Strode, and Raul fucking Julia.
Amen.
Actresses Dinah Shore and Anita Morris, directors Derek Jarman.
Mm-hmm.
My fave.
Mm-hmm.
Of Edward II, discussed in our 1992 episode. I go on about that guy every chance I get.
Yep.
And Lindsay Anderson of If, discussed in our 1968 episode.
Okay.
Screenwriters Dennis Potter, Michael O'Donohue, and Joan Harrison. Composer Henry Mancini, the guy behind the Pink Panther theme. He made a lot of other things, too.
Yes, but that's the one where, like, if you hum that, people know the song you're talking about.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
The great Cab Calloway, the icon Burt Lancaster, and the one, the only, the legend, John Candy. And that's your Hollywood Minute.
All right, Bob, you want to do a lightning round?
Yes.
All right, here's how it works. I'm going to feed you a list of titles pulled from John Willis's Screen World Film Manual for 94. You can comment briefly on each or pass if you wish. And here we go. Clerks.
Not a fan.
The Shawshank Redemption.
A movie that I appreciated later in life for the screenplay.
Oliver Stone's Natural Born Killers.
Pass.
Martin Short as Clifford.
Don't know anything about it.
Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Just watched it again, held up like crazy.
Robert Redford's Quiz Show.
Great movie.
Clear and Present Danger.
Has not aged well.
Interview with a Vampire.
Don't know anything about it.
John Waters' Serial Mom.
I love John Waters' top 10 lists. I will say that. Did you see what his review of Oppenheimer was?
I did not.
It was his favorite film of the year. He said it's a three-hour movie about talking. And I feel like he's the only one who, like, knew what that movie was. It was a genius.
Tom Noonan's What Happened Was.
I just watched that recently, actually. And I love Tom Noonan. He's amazing.
Spike Lee's Crooklyn.
Never seen it.
Rose Troche's Go Fish.
Never saw it.
Robert Altman's Ready to Wear, a.k.a. Prêt-à-Porter.
Tried to watch.
Gus Van Sant's Even Cowgirls Get the Blues.
You know, everyone told me that movie was terrible, and I went to see for myself, and it's unbelievably bad.
Bernardo Bertolucci's Little Buddha.
Don't know it.
Louis Malle's Vanya on 42nd Street.
Thought in Telluride, and talked to the woman from Silence of the Lambs who's in that. I think her, what's her name?
Brooke Smith.
And it was so funny. I remember talking to her. I'm like, oh, yeah, I saw that movie, Uncle Vanya, and you're really great in it. And I think you're going to get like, I said something like, I think you're going to get like a lot of attention for it. And I'm talking to this woman who, you know, was probably stopped in the street 10,000 times. And she just looked at me with the most vacant expression a face can make, like escaped from a loony bin.
The aforementioned Jennifer Jason Leigh in Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle.
Didn't see it, but probably should, because I really like her a lot. And I think I should probably see that.
Gary Oldman in Immortal Beloved.
Never saw it.
David O. Russell's Spanking the Monkey.
I think that movie had a big impact on a lot of people.
Whit Stillman's Barcelona.
I have a story about that. I actually just asked Whit Stillman for a hotel recommendation in Barcelona. And because I was just in Barcelona, and he said in the email, he said, you're going to have to watch my movie again. And I just love that he's still plugging his movie.
A filmmaker's work is never done. Yeah. David Mamet's Oleana.
Just watched that again recently, and Mamet was a big influence on Lousy Carter.
That totally scans. Allison Anders' Mi Vida Loca.
I never saw it.
The 94 version of Little Women.
Not the Target Market.
Hoop Dreams.
Saw it at Sundance, and didn't have a place to stay, so I wanted it to keep going, even though it's obviously really long.
Yeah.
But when it was going to end, I had to confront not having a place to stay, so I just wanted it to play and play and play.
Bob, where did you end up staying after Hoop Dreams ended?
No recollection.
John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness.
Don't know it, but I have a lot of respect for him, of course.
Adam Sandler and Brendan Fraser and Steve Buscemi as Airheads.
I think I saw that. It's embarrassing.
Roger Avery's Killing Zoe.
Saw that. I love Roger Avery. He's a friend, and he's got a zest for filmmaking that I don't know that anyone else has. And I love his podcast.
Ace Ventura, Pet Detective.
I think I saw it, and Jim Carrey hasn't really aged very well for me. Those performances, it feels like they sort of curdled a little bit.
That totally makes sense. And finally, Edward Zwick's Legends of the Fall.
Well, I know Zwick is sort of on my Twitter feed, and I like mm-hmm. Says, and I've never seen Glory, and I should see Glory, right? It's good, isn't it?
It's very good, yes.
But I don't know if I'm going to see Legends of the Fall. It just looks kind of top heavy, or like it just, I don't know.
That is, you know what? You haven't seen the movie, and you've just accurately assessed it. And that concludes the lightning round. Bob, excellent work on that. The film again is Lousy Carter in theaters and on digital. Are you on social media? Can people follow you anywhere?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I have like 1,000 followers. It's not. Krumholtz was killing it on Twitter, and then he deactivated his account.
Yeah.
So that's been hard for us.
I am Fun City Cinema on Instagram, Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd, where you can find under my list the top fives for every episode of the show. Mike, where can people find you?
I am at Brainwashed Lib on Twitter and Fifth Column Films on Blue Sky.
And of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, please do leave us a rating and a review on your podcatcher of choice. There's just an absurd number of movie podcasts out there, so your recommendations really do help us out. Mike, before we go, what is your parting recommendation for 94?
I think I'm going to go with Arizona Dreams, despite the accurate description of Johnny Depp earlier. It's sure. Got to, I think my favorite Jerry Lewis movies are like King of Comedy, and mm-hmm. They're movies late in his career that were made by people who were using his character, mm-hmm. his sort of, and he was fine with it, mm-hmm. like fully leaned into the performances. And Jerry Lewis, I mean, you know, Johnny Depp's fine. He doesn't make the movie. He doesn't ruin it. But Faye Dunaway is just all over this movie.
Yep.
Just being very, very just sort of unique and weird in a, I don't know, like I have an enduring relationship with this movie that is sort of hard to explain. It's an odd film. There's not really any point in getting into what it's about, because what it's about is Jerry Lewis and Faye Dunaway acting all over the movie. And I just really, I particularly like him. And you know, he's a used car salesman in this fucking movie. Like, is there a better role for late stage Jerry Lewis?
Yeah.
I don't think there is, you know? So it's one of those things where like, it's not necessarily, you know, it's not the best movie that came out in 94,
right?
But it's one that I really enjoy, and especially sort of banged up against King of Comedy somehow. To me, it's just a really, I really like it. And I've watched, and every time I put it on, you know, it's one of those movies that I put on just sort of that's running in the background because I've seen it before and I don't necessarily need to pay attention to it. And then they're in the parking lot with that big rotating caddy and I'm just watching the fucking movie now. So Arizona Dream, you don't need to, don't worry about the Johnny Depp, wait for the Jerry Lewis. How about you?
You know, I'm a big fan of the sort of the neo-noir 90s indie movie. And one of the best came out in 94, which is Romeo is Bleeding, starring Gary Oldman. He was also in the Professional that year, Leon, whatever you want to call it. I think this performance is just as unhinged, but stretched out to feature length. It's about, you know, a dirty cop and all of the dirty shit that he's into and how it all kind of backs up on him at once. And it's just sweaty and desperate and sexy. And Lena Olin is just to die for in this movie, rather literally. It's a movie that time has sort of forgotten, but it's worth checking out. That's Romeo is Bleeding. There's my additional recommendation. Thank you again, Bob Byington, for taking the time to come on the show.
Thank you. Had a blast.
Glad to hear it. And go see Lousy Carter, everybody. It's terrific. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening.
It was a very good year.